you very much for joining us in this workshop on the VT system. We're very lucky to meet the victim that is a workshop on the critical point in the culture.
I'm also giving a colloquium on Wednesday, I guess. So I want to go straight into.
Sorry to interrupt. Oh, yes. Thank you.
So I'm going to
Is that working? Yeah? Okay. Right, so on Wednesday, I guess, I'll introduce the system and historically and, you know, in a rather general way for a general audience. But today I want to look at some specific issues. So let me just very quickly run through the context that I'm in. So I have a compact Riemann surface. Genus bigger than one, and today it's just the group GLN. So I'm looking at a holomorphic vector bundle of rank n, and the Higgs field, meaning a holomorphic section of the endomorphism bundle tensored with a canonical bundle. And then for this pair of objects, the vector bundle and the Higgs field, there's a stability condition which says that there's a good moduli space for this. And this moduli space is a complex symplectic manifold. So, of course, there's a backstory to this, which is all to do with gauge theoretic equations. But this talk will be essentially about the complex structure I of the hyperkähler family. So it's just about M as a complex symplectic manifold. And now when we have, so this is just the general linear group. So we take the standard invariant functions. So I've chosen this way to parameterize the vibration. So for each of these pairs of objects, a vector bundle and a Higgs field, I take the traces of the powers, and that gives me a holomorphic map to this vector space, which I've called A here, a sum of differentials of different degrees. And that means that if I take an element in the dual space of A, then this defines a function on M, function on a symplectic manifold, there's a Hamiltonian vector field, and to say that this is an integrable system says that all these Hamiltonian vector fields commute. So that's the situation that I'm in. H is... important factor is H is a proper map, that it's, the derivative is generically surjective and a regular value. If I take the inverse image of a regular value, then this is a torus, compact torus. And the question I want to ask is what are the critical points of this H? I mean, we say a lot about the generic fibers, But what are the critical points? What are the zeros of the Hamiltonian vector field for some element f in the dual space of this vector space base? First of all, to kind of describe how I want to look at these things, just let's look at the generic fiber at the regular value. And let's ask the question about why is that a torus? Why is that a complex torus? Because it's a rather special complex torus. So this brings in the spectral curve. So again, I'm in the general linear group situation. So we look at the characteristic polynomial of that Higgs field. And then the coefficients, of course, are universal polynomials in whatever basis of invariant functions you choose. So I chose the B1 up to Bn to be given by the traces of the powers. So the coefficients of the characteristic polynomial are certain universal polynomials in these. Anyway, they're determined uniquely by the base, the element base. And then, so this is basically setting up the context that I like to think of. that I regard X here as the, I take the cotangent bundle of sigma, so this is a non-compact complex surface, total space of the canonical bundle. And then when you pull back the canonical bundle from sigma to the total space as a tautological section, that's what I call X, but you can also think of this as the canonical one form on the cotangent bundle of any manifold, in this case of the Riemann surface sigma. So then the equation of the spectral curve, this characteristic polynomial, can be written this way, and it becomes the vanishing of the of a section of the nth power of the pullback of the canonical bundle. And informally, what happens, of course, is that you think of X as being a well-defined eigenvalue of the Higgs field. So on this spectral curve, which is an n-fold cover of sigma, then X is a well-defined single-valued eigenvalue, and there's a corresponding eigenspace, which is, okay, we think of as a line bundle over this spectral curve. So the feature then is that actually this the torus over the point B is naturally isomorphic, well, more or less naturally isomorphic, to the torus of degree zero line bundles on S. And the way that you get back to the Higgs field from the Higgs bundle from the line bundle is to take the direct image. So the direct image is this construction in algebraic geometry. If you take an open set, any open set in sigma, then you look at the inverse image upstairs. So if this was a neighborhood of a regular value, you get n distinct copies of U. And you look at you define the holomorphic sections of the direct image over U to be the holomorphic sections on the inverse image of this line bundle L. So this is now the sections of an n-dimensional, rank n vector bundle, and it's defined canonically in terms of L by this direct image construction. And then what about the Higgs field itself? Well, X is this tautological section of pi star of k. It acts on sections of L by multiplication, and then the direct image of that gives you the Higgs field over here. So that's the basic description of the relationship between degree zero line bundles on the spectral curve and Higgs field. Now we're interested in taking elements of the dual space of the base. So this is really just for reference. So you can apply said duality. So A here. A was the direct sum of sections of powers of the canonical bundle. So said duality says that the dual can be identified with the direct sum of these H1s. And so you want to know what does the, if I take something in here, then I get a Hamiltonian vector field on my manifold, which goes tangentially to the fibers. So one wants to ask, what does this Hamiltonian vector field look like on a, let's say, on a smooth fiber? And this is the way you do it. So this is, it's a side issue in this paper of David Borelia, but this is concretely what happens. So you take, and it's basically realizing said duality in terms of this vector field. So you take an element in here, mu k, you pull it back to the spectral curve, and you multiply it by this power, so this becomes a section of k to the 1 minus k, you multiply it by this x to the k minus 1, which is a section of k to the k minus 1, and you get a class in here. And this class is the tangent space to the Jacobian of the spectral curve. That's exactly where we want the vector field to point. And this is the formula that Borelia gave. So it's essentially a question of how do you choose a basis for the invariant polynomials, and once you've chosen that, how do you write the vector fields? So for each choice, there'll be a corresponding vector field. So this is the way you get the vector field. And by continuity, if you like, I mean, this formula here is perfectly well defined, even when the spectral curve is singular, and it's the singular curves that we're going to be interested in. So okay, so that was a regular value, and then on the regular value, all these Hamiltonian vector fields. Okay, if you take a basis for A, CM I've written here, then these vector fields are everywhere linearly independent on the fiber over a regular value, the torus, so they span the tangent bundle of the torus. And so what we're looking for is linear dependence of these vector fields at some point. And clearly this is going to involve a singular spectral curve. So we know very, very well about the discriminant locus in the base. So these are, if you like, the critical values. But I'm interested in understanding where the critical points are, where a holomorphic Hamiltonian vector field vanishes. So here's the issue. That formula that I gave was all on. These are all on S, right? But essentially, everything here is defined on the surface, on the cotangent bundle. X is the tautological section. I can pull back things from the base. So really, what we're saying is that we take this expression and we restrict it to the curve in order to get a tangent vector to the fiber. So really, we should be saying that actually there's something in this infinite dimensional space, in fact, which is built up out of these same objects, and we restrict it to the spectral curve. So actually, what happens is that you don't lose anything. So long as these the powers of x are less than the degree of the spectral curve, then you don't lose any information by this restriction. So basically, there's this proposition here that even when the curve is singular, and you know, defining this is perfectly all right because we use the exact sequences, right? The ideal sheaf of the curve and so on. We're working on a smooth surface, so we define all these things by looking at restrictions from the O of the surface, the total space of the canonical bundle of the curve. And so the point is that actually every element in here can be written uniquely in this form where the k just goes to n minus 1. So when we get to x to the n, then of course there's an equation which rewrites x to the n in terms of the lower powers of x. So uniqueness doesn't hold there. So this is an important point, that actually we don't lose any information by going down. This is why I say that, so what happens then is that actually this Hamiltonian vector field, which is built up out of these same pieces, if I restrict this to,
basic question. If this was in the context of physics, if I have some physical model, like sigma model that could be described by some Newtonian system, it's a classical equation. And then for each solution, I can construct an algebraic curve. These critical points that we are after, what would be their physical meaning?
Well, this is these are certain. Okay, so we're. Well, the physical meaning, yeah, I mean.
You had a superpotential. So you break an superpotential, then the potential becomes a function of this exactly the same function. And you're looking for the potential.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I don't think I could answer that question. So here's a kind of contradiction. Well, it's not really a contradiction. So we know that this vector field restricts. This should be HSO, but it's, if you like, as a vector field, it's non-trivial on the Jacobian, even of the spectral curve. And so so that means it has no zeros on this part of the fiber, if you like. So if we insist that we're looking at parts of the fiber which are given by line bundles, which are parameterized by this, then we won't find zero. So let me put it another way. We take even a singular spectral curve, and we take a line bundle on it, and do what I said, take the Dirac image and get a Higgs field, then that won't be a zero of this vector field. And why? Well, so the reason is this, that the H is the fiber, any fiber is compact, it's a proper map, but the Jacobian, or the space of line bundles on degree zero line bundles on the singular curve is non-compact. When it becomes singular, basically you get something like products of C stars under torus, maybe kind of slightly twisted. So the point is that the actual fiber is a compactification. It has to be compact. And it's understood now to be a compactive, well, Simpson, in fact, basically told us this, that it's a compactification by rank one stable, I think the word is pure, torsion-free sheaf. So we have to understand the fixed point, certainly in the context of torsion-free sheaves and not in terms of line bundles. So in order to demonstrate this, what I usually do is just look at the simplest possible case of rank 2 and SL2C. So this is the lowest interesting case of Higgs bundles. So now we're going to take the vector bundle to be rank 2 and have so it's an SL2C bundle. And the Higgs field should lie in the Lie algebra, and so its trace should be equal to zero. Then the only invariant polynomial is, trace of phi squared. This is a quadratic differential, holomorphic section of k squared, and the equation of the spectral curve is essentially this. So life becomes much simpler here because we can forget about the more complicated formula, that the base is now the vector space, the 3G minus 3-dimensional vector space of quadratic differentials, and said duality says the dual space is given by this. So we can look at what happens then. So the spectral curve, so we know that if we're looking for fixed points, then we have to be looking at singular spectral curve. So S in this case is singular if the quadratic differential has zeros of multiplicity greater than 1. I mean, so it's a very simple equation, right? X squared minus q equals zero. So what do we do? So when we look at this direct image picture, then suppose we start by trying to understand what happens if we do take a line bundle on this singular curve and take the direct image. What kind of Higgs bundle do we get then? It's not going to be a fixed point, but let's see what we do get. So we have locally, we can think of choose coordinates such that the holomorphically the equation of the curve looks like this. And then if we look at the inverse image if we look at functions, local functions, holomorphic functions on the inverse image of z equals zero, then basically it's a two-dimensional space over as a module over the functions of z. And so we've got f0 of z plus f1 of z. But now if we take a line bundle, the line bundle is locally trivial, so the local behavior would look just like this. And so we could think of this pair of functions as being a local trivialization or a local section of the vector bundle. So when we want to understand the Higgs field, we multiply this by x and then rewrite it in these terms. And what you see is that the Higgs field looks like this. So indeed, the determinant is minus z to the m. But the thing to notice is that the Higgs field is actually non-vanishing at z equals zero. So when you take a line bundle, in this case, you take the direct image, then you get a perfectly well-defined Higgs field, but it doesn't vanish at z equals zero. Now, fortunately, so there's this fact about the sheaves that we're considering, that torsion-free sheaf, you can understand the torsion-free sheaf, rank one torsion-free sheaf, in terms of line bundles, not on S, but on a normalization or partial normalization. So you can, if you take a, so when S is singular, there's always a unique normalization of that, but you could normalize around, locally normalize around the singularity. So here's the situation. So suppose we have a zero of the quadratic differential of multiplicity 2m, then the normalization of the local normalization of this curve is given by two components, x equals z to the m and x equals minus z to the m. So instead of having this singularity, you just separate them out, and z is a coordinate, a local coordinate on each of them. So then it's pretty obvious that x is going to look like this. So here the Higgs field is, the Higgs field vanishes completely, but it's divisible by z to the m in the neighborhood of this point. And in this case, it's z to the m times something which is semi-simple at z equals zero. So when you look at the odd degree case, then in this case, the normalization is given by a parameter t. And so when you put, if you put that into the picture, then, okay, so you take a function like this, then the Higgs field looks like this. So now when we divide by z to the m, we get something which is 0, 1, 0, and is 0 at z equals 0. So the difference between odd and even is whether this, when you've divided out by the z to the m, whether what you get is nilpotent or otherwise. So that's what happens. So when you take a line bundle on this singular spectral curve and take the direct image, you get a Higgs field which is non-vanishing at that point. It's the torsion-free sheaves which give you where the Higgs field vanishes. So we conclude that actually, if we're looking for a critical point, then it requires the phi to vanish at some point, some points of the spectral curve. Some points of sigma itself. Phi is defined on sigma. Okay, well, what's this got to do? Okay, so now we look more directly at the derivative of this map. So the way I traditionally think of these things is in kind of gauge theoretic terms. So I think of a holomorphic structure on a vector bundle as being given by a D bar operator. So I take a fixed C infinity bundle and think of a D bar operator parameterized by A, which defines the holomorphic structure. So we have this, if you like, we have this infinite dimensional space of D bar operators. That is the space of all holomorphic structures on a fixed C infinity bundle. Yeah?
That's
right, not for multiplicities, not for high, not when the curve itself has high multiplicities. It's for singular curves, but it could work for reducible curves if they're, if each component has zero. Okay, if you take, so I have a singular curve, which is, but if I take a line bundle, then I know automatically that's not going to be a fixed point. But how do I see that in the Higgs bundle picture? I see a Higgs field which is non-vanishing at that point. If I have a torsion-free sheaf, then I'm going to get vanished. So anyway, so in gauge theoretic terms, I think of an infinitesimal deformation. So I think of an A as being basically given by a 0, 1 form with values in the endomorphisms of V, and phi is, okay, then phi is this section of the endomorphisms tensored with canonical bundle. And this is the equation, but then the infinitesimal variation of that, if I think of that as A dot and phi dot, tells me that the tangents, I can write the tangent space as, so I look at the first derivative of this, and I look at it this way. Now, that's kind of the way that I mostly in the past think about tangents. And what it suggests is the following, that A dot is basically an infinitesimal variation in the holomorphic structure of V. So there's an obvious map from the tangent space of M into this H1, namely the cohomology class of the A dot. When A dot is equal to zero, we're fixing the holomorphic structure and varying the Higgs field, which explains this. And then when you've got automorphisms, there's a bit here and a bit there. But when V is stable, then you don't have these automorphisms. And basically what this is, this exact sequence is then, actually alpha is then the derivative of the a different map, not the map we're talking about now. We know that the cotangent bundle of the moduli space of stable bundles is a big open set inside there. And then the projection onto N is basically, the derivative of that is basically this. So that's not what I want, but I just put it there as a point of comparison. But so if you look at it in a more abstract way, then what this is a Dolbo, well, it's a way of expressing the first hypercohomology of a complex of sheaves. So it's a very small complex of sheaves. We take the sheaf of holomorphic sections of the endomorphisms of V, and we take the bracket with phi, which goes this way. So basically, there's a double complex here. There's this, and zeros there, and then this, if you like, you can think of the d-bar operators going down, and or you could think of check operators going down as well. So one way of saying this is that you have a double complex, and there are two spectral sequences associated with a double complex. One of them gives you this. Well, one of them gives you this, but there's another one which is more relevant to us, which actually looks this, like this. So we're now looking at H1 of this is the kernel sheaf, or the sheaf of centralizers of phi. So we're looking at the kernel of this, that's a sheaf. It's the sheaf of all endomorphisms which commute with phi. And then there's a corresponding expression here for the co-kernel. So what happens in our SL2C case? Well, as we know, in the Lie algebra of SL2, if A is a non-zero element, either semisimple or nilpotent, then if something commutes with it, then it's given by a multiple of A. So actually, this is a very simple, this kernel of phi is phi acting by the adjoint representation. Is a very simple object. And in fact, if phi is non-vanishing everywhere, then phi actually identifies all multiples of phi with multiples of k to the minus 1. So you can identify this sheaf actually with just the holomorphic sections of k to the minus 1. And so if phi is not equal to 0, then your H1, as this, okay, you look at the co-kernel and you find out what it is by some duality. And then what happens is that this map here, this beta, is now turns out to be the derivative of H. So the other spectral sequence gave the derivative of the map to stable bundles. This one gives the derivative of H. So if phi is not equal to zero, then we have this. And so we see, well, we knew it already, I guess, but if V is the direct image of a line bundle, then phi is non-vanishing everywhere. So the kernel sheaf is k to the minus 1. And then, so this is what we get. And the derivative of H is surjective. So that's not a critical point. But if phi vanishes on the divisor, then we've already seen that it's in this particular case, it's pretty simple, because when we divided by z to the m, so when the degree of vanishing was 2m or 2m plus 1, when we divided by z to the m, then we got something which was non-vanishing at z equals 0, either nilpotent or semisimple. So in fact, this then you can still identify this kernel sheaf. It's just it gets twisted by this divisor, which has, if you like, a multiplicity m when the quadratic differential has 0 of degree 2m, or 2m plus 1. And there's a corresponding image there. So so you can check that these things actually add up the right dimension. So in this case, the derivative of h is actually, okay, derivative of h goes to h0 k squared. It's given by the image of this. So we go to here, and then we multiply by s, and we get here. So it factors through this, and there's... So what does that mean? I mean, turn it the other way around. It says that if I take something in the dual space of A, dual space of the quadratic differentials, then this annihilates this image here if SA is equal to 0 in here. So A is H1. S is a section of the line bundle which vanishes on the divisor D. And we want this to vanish inside this. So that what does that say? That says that that this is telling us, okay, that telling us which elements of a dual give us vanishing vector fields at this point. So we're at a point where we have a Higgs field which vanishes at various points. So we know that we're going to construct this by direct image of torsion-free sheaf. And so, in fact, for each of those points, so if these were simple points, you know, if these were, say, multiplicity 2, we would have, so if we had, I don't know, k points of multiplicity 2 and no others, then we would have k functions whose Hamiltonian vector fields vanish at this point. Of course, when you've got multiplicity, then you've got higher order objects. So this is the condition. And then, but you can make this very concrete. So this is just exact sequence of sheaves on sigma. This is equal to 0 because the degree of this is always less than 2g minus 2. So basically, if you've got something in here, I called it A, which goes to 0 here. It comes from something here. These are sections which are supported on this set of points. So another way of saying that in concrete terms is that you can take the Dolbo representative of this class here is basically supported on this set of points, on this divisor. So what you do is you take, okay, you have this value, this is like a skyscraper sheaf, if you like, you take the value of this at each point, or maybe it's involving its derivative, you extend it locally, then you multiply it by a bump function, and then you take d bar of it, and then what you've got is divisible by S because alpha was holomorphic in a neighborhood of the zero D. So it's convenient to think of it this way. If your Dolbo representative of a class like this looks like D bar alpha over S. So, okay, so here we are. The simplest scenario is a quadratic differential with n double zeros. That corresponds to a point in the fiber where n linearly independent Hamiltonian vector fields vanish. So once you've identified critical points, of course, you know, you want to look at the Hessian, second derivative. And so here you can go back. So now we want to look at a second order variation of these things. So think of t as being a small parameter. And then the equation, so these are this is the first order equation, and then we get this second order equation here. And we want to look at the integral here, trace of phi squared, where evaluated, so trace of phi squared is a quadratic differential, but now we evaluate it against this element, and this is something in the dual space. This is our element A, which is. We know it has to be of this form when we have a critical point. And so when you expand that, you'll see that the second variation looks like this. So the point to make now is that that phi actually vanished to the same degree as S did, and that was the way we defined this S. So phi over S is holomorphic and smooth. So we can take the D bar across there, and so we can rewrite this in terms of, D bar, there's a term here which involves the trace of phi D bar phi double dot times alpha over S. So if you look at this, then if you use this formula here, you can rewrite this in terms of these things. Trace of phi A double dot bracket phi is equal to zero. Anyway, what you get is this, that the Stokes theorem gives you the full second variation, looks like this. But this is a boundary integral. So, quite naturally, alpha vanishes outside of some neighborhoods anyway. But you can reformulate this as a boundary integral and then evaluate it as a residue. So the Hessian looks basically like this. So it's localized in terms of the trace of these phi dot squareds. It's the residue. So if we had a simple zero, or if a quadratic differential had a degree 2 zero, then this will be just the evaluation of phi dot at the origin. Okay, so so what have we done there? We've kind of looked at the situation where the spectral curve was singular, but non-reduced, but reduced. Then you can also look at the nilpotent cone. So this is where the Higgs field is. The Higgs field is nilpotent everywhere. So the equation of the spectral curve is x squared equals zero. Yeah?
So if I think a generic linear function is,
yeah,
how many critical points?
Well, they're always, they're not isolated, right? Yeah. Because you've got all these other vector fields. Right? Okay, the only there are no isolated critical points. First of all, you've got all the other Hamiltonian vector fields which push them around. But also, even if you go right down, the place where all the Hamiltonian vector fields vanished is where the Higgs field is zero, so the moduli space of stable points. But then that's higher dimensional anyway. So there are no there are no isolated critical points. But we can use this information about the Hessian actually, in this particular case. So here I'm looking at, I'm thinking of, not now of looking at direct images of torsion-free sheaves. I could do, and there's a language in which you can do that called the language of ribbons, so curve with multiplicity 2, but we know very well in this case of SL2C what this nilpotent cone looked like. Well, we know to a certain extent what it looked like, but there are some aspects of it which we don't yet. So if the Higgs field is nilpotent, then it has a well-defined kernel. The Higgs field can vanish at points, but nevertheless, there's a line bundle, which, the sheaf generates a line bundle. And so the vector bundle is actually an extension of a line bundle by dual, in this case, because it's SL2C. And the Higgs field, since L is the kernel, by definition, the kernel of the Higgs field is a homomorphism from this into this tensor L to the K. So it's a holomorphic section of L squared K. So the stability condition tells you that this Higgs field actually has to be non-zero. And so that tells you that the degree of this line bundle must be greater than or equal to zero, which gives you some constraints on the degree of L. So L is a negative degree. That's what stability says. It's an invariant subbundle of L, invariant by the Higgs field. And so D is... Okay, so I think I've called the degree of L minus D. Okay. All right, so D takes these values. But the The important thing is that if D is not equal to G minus 1, then the Higgs field has to have 0. So we're in the same situation now. We don't have to go through the, I mean, you can see what happens there. So the Higgs field here has 0. So if we take an element in H1 k to the minus 1 of the form D bar alpha over S, then again we're going to get actually a critical point. So what happens here? So the inverse image of 0, this nilpotent cone, is made up of Lagrangian components. In rather a complicated fashion. One of them is the case where the Higgs field is 0. This is the moduli space of stable bundles, or polystable in this case, it's degree 0. And it's the degree of this which determines the other component. And the other components, in fact, are, well, they're coverings of a vector bundle over a symmetric product of the curve. So we know very well what they look like. But for us, the important point is that the Higgs field has zeros if the degree of L squared K is greater than 0. So in fact, unless in the case where this is trivial, in which case it has no zeros, then all these components are actually critical points for H. So we have a complicated picture. Right at the top, we have, in fact, we have a copy of C3G minus 3. Well, we have actually 2 to the 2G copies of C3G minus 3. They're not critical points. But then as you go down, you get these others, which are critical points. So these are, you can actually use this calculation of the Hessian actually to say something about homology classes of these. So if I look at the inverse image of 0, then it's homologous to inverse image of any smooth fiber. So the homology class has different components. It's built up out of the closure of each of these components that I'm talking about. So each, what I described was an open Lagrangian submanifold. It was this vector bundle over a covering of the symmetric product. But if you look at its closure, then that gives us something compact. That carries a homology class. And of course, each homology class has a multiplicity. So we can actually show that the Hessians at a general point on one of these components are linearly independent, which tells you actually the multiplicity of each component. So these are the results. Tamás Hauzel actually, he gave many years ago another argument calculating these homology classes using the intersection with some other ones, some non-compact. But we can use this property of the Hessian, this means of calculating the Hessian, to actually get these. Okay, so finally, I want to talk about another feature, a rather intriguing feature about these fixed points, and I'm not quite sure how one can make use of this. So, I've said already that a torsion-free sheaf we can think of as the direct image of a line bundle on some partial normalization of the spectral curve. So if I we're now back in the general situation. If I now take something, a function in the dual space of A, then it gives me this class called AF in here. And the flow of this Hamiltonian vector field is basically this. So this is the flow on the Jacobian of S. Well, we're looking for fixed points, then we're not interested in that. But we can pull it back, okay, and look at the flow on the normalization. So here, L primed is supposed to be the line bundle on this normalization, whose direct image is a torsion-free sheaf on here, which is which we want to give us a fixed point. So in order to get a fixed point, we would like this action to be trivial on the normalization. Well, how is that going to happen? It can only happen if this class here is trivial on normalization. So fixed point of the flow will correspond to pulling back this class AF in H1SO, or if you like, coming from H1KO to S prime. So what does that mean? Well, if we think of it geometrically, previously we've been thinking of this as the tangent vector, tangent space to the Jacobian vector curve, but now we can think of it in a different way. We can think of it as defining a principal C bundle. Okay, so this is a principal bundle with action with group the additive group C. So if we think of it that way, if we think of AF as first of all, it's a restriction of a class in here, and that to which defines a principal a three-dimensional manifold, if you like, a principal C bundle over the cotangent bundle of sigma. And so what are we saying? We're saying that if we have a map now from this normalization S primed into K, such that this class is zero on S primed, it means that it restricts. It means that this bundle is trivial over S primed, so we get a section. In other words, there's a map from S primed into Z. So the normalization of this curve actually gives you, in order to get a fixed point, it gives you a curve in Z. So this is a Kolbe-Yau three-fold. Okay, so canonical bundle is symplectic. We have this principal C bundle over the canonical bundle. So actually, I don't know what importance that has. Maybe at the end of this week, somebody can tell me whether it does or doesn't. Anyway, what it means is that a fixed point a fixed point for some function f in A star defines us a curve in this particular Kolbe-Yau threefold. So it's a Kolbe-Yau threefold, which is determined by this function f. Is it a
Poynting bundle or a
it's determined by a class I'll tell you what it is in two dimensions, but in Flare SL2, no, we just take an element f in the dual space of A, and that defines us so it's probably that's what it is. Okay, so let's look at it this way. It has a more concrete description actually for SL2C. So here you can think of it another way. Because this class AF, A, okay, so let's put it. This class inside here, inside the surface, involves pulling back some classes on sigma and multiplying that by powers of x. In this case, you just multiply by this, the class is linear in x, which means that actually there's another interpretation. So here's my A, so this is what I called F previously. So this is now something in the dual space of the base. And what is it? It's an element in here that defines me an extension. Okay? It defines me a rank 2 vector bundle over sigma like this. And we have this trivial section here, and I can translate by that, which gives me a free C action on this. So this is, if you like, the total space of this rank 2 vector bundle over sigma is the three-dimensional manifold. Yeah, okay.
Can I think about this time as arising from a pair of the fixed field and other?
Okay, field? That's probably my next slide, yeah. Actually. Okay, so there are two things now. This say, well, not this next slide, a couple of slides. So There are two things to say about this. First is, we might as well, if you write the holomorphic structure on this rank two bundle like this, so this is our co-cycle here, this is our Dolbo form, then you could take x, y, and z to be local holomorphic coordinates, and then, okay, all I'm saying is it's pretty straightforward to see how the normalization, how these singular curves, these local forms for the singular curves, actually lift into this vector bundle as a smooth curve. So this is the more interesting point. So, well, we've encountered this before, but anyway, a critical point is, by definition, satisfies that for all phi dot, and so implies that A phi is equal to zero in here. I mean, we've had a specific way of looking at this with the d bar alpha over s. So in our case, we've got d bar alpha over s times phi. So that actually is d bar of something. And this is perfectly well defined because phi vanishes exactly when s vanishes. So actually we can solve this in Dolbo terms by using psi. And then what you get is basically a lifting. So your phi was a Higgs field with values in the line bundle on K, but now we have a Higgs field with values in this vector bundle here. And it's not just a general one because in fact psi locally looks like psi looks like this, which means that psi commutes with phi. And so another way of saying that is that this Higgs field, this extended Higgs field, satisfies phi tilde with phi tilde equals zero. And that's okay, so we can compare that with when Simpson defined Higgs bundles for higher dimensions, then he required this condition to hold for the where you take the vector bundle with a cotangent bundle. But there's a scope here for actually twisting the Higgs field by E. So locally, I agree, this is given by a pair of objects which commute. Like having two Higgs fields which commute, except you can't, they're not globally a pair because it's non-trivial. Okay, so that's two different ways of looking at these fixed points. So one is okay, and when you do it in this way, then you can argue as Simpson did actually. Whoops. The sheaf. I mean, when you have two commuting things, then locally, then they correspond to a sheaf on a curve in this higher dimensional manner. I don't know what I did there. Anyway, I better stop. So obviously you've encountered something like this before.
Yes, at some point people have been looking at the formation of stuff. So I think what should be curious if I get to the first. And there are something called an equal wonder formation where you make some sort of limit by adding a potential on the space. And indeed, from temporary considerations, it was really possible that the possible solution correspond to sort of this sort of pairs of having a curve moving in a radial. Because it would have half as much. Somehow the shape of the cardial was to encode which superpotential it had. But I don't think there was a systematic analysis for generic first, more like for the specific examples you recall.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Did you know something about geometry?
Yeah, I'm not sure about how much information you can, how much detailed information you can get, actually. Even calculating these multiplicities, calculating the multiplicity, I could choose a generic point with the Hessian, but for a specific, I don't know. I mean, you know, if we reformulate this in terms of a curve inside this Calabi Yau, and then you ask what is the Hessian? I mean, if we understand that as a critical point, what is the geometry? What geometry in this curve in the Calabi Yau corresponds to this Hessian? Then I don't know. I mean, it's right. There's a possibility of transforming it. I should say that actually I got into this picture in particular by thinking of Naam's equations. So, I mean, Naam's equations are very similar to this, except the base is a projective line, and you twist with the O2 instead of with the canonical bundle. And in that case, instead of this three-dimensional Calabi Yau, you actually get P3. I mean, you get O1 plus O1, you have P3. So curves in P3. So if I'm looking for fixed points of what I call the Naam flow, which is fixed points on some moduli space of solutions, generic, which are like Naam's equations modulo conjugation, then it corresponds to curves inside the P3 base curve.
What
limits the argument for higher rank for the moment? There's an obvious guess. Good question. I mean, linear independence of the quadratic, I mean, of the Hessians, in order to get the degree formula, the multiplicity formula, I had to choose some, I mean, it took me a while to think of what generic point to choose. And it actually, I could take a decomposable vector bundle, and then I could argue with, the canonical embedding of the curve. But, I mean, I think, but so that might be suggestive that one could go to the fixed point of the circle action for the other higher dimensional components, and then get some genericity in terms of the. I don't know, but I think it's not quite so simple. I mean, I think it comes down to the bundle of centralizers, basically. I mean, the bundle of centralizers is more complicated. So instead of looking at points where the Higgs field vanishes, you've got to look at points where it becomes irregular, right? So it's not such a simple question. But I mean, I think these formulas agree with what you told me for your previous calculation. Yeah.
As you move in the space of the base, or the dual plane, the Calabi Yau will evolve in a way.
Yeah.
And then the curves.
Yeah, so, I mean, question of the rigidity, you're right. You have this family of non-compact Calabi Yaus over this space. Yeah, each one has a C action. So, I mean, the curves are not rigid, but maybe in some sense. I mean, obviously, you know, because it's a principal bundle, you have a choice of how you lift the curve depending on the action. One thing at a time. I think physicists somehow know more about that than some. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. No, of course, there's quite an industry. Maybe some people here. I don't know, is Phil here? Yeah, no, I shouldn't say that. But I don't.
Any more questions? That's a big applause. I guess.